Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in a work that really fundamentally changed how we think about people and nature. Aldo Leopold's A Sand County Almanac.
Yeah, it's so much more than just, you know, pretty nature essays. People love it for that. But it's a philosophical blueprint, a really revolutionary one for ecological citizenship.
Absolutely. It's kind of the cornerstone, isn't it, of modern environmental thought.
It really is. So our mission today really is to give you the shortcut to understanding Leopold's core idea, this thing he called the land ethic.
And we want to show you why, you know, decades after he wrote it, this framework is maybe the most vital tool we have for tackling the big challenges: biodiversity loss, climate change.
Exactly. Because it challenges something so deep in our culture, we hardly even see it sometimes.
Which,
this idea of land as just property, something passive, right? Something we own, we exploit, we optimize just for us, for human gain.
Right. And Leopold says, no, we need to shift. We need to see the land as this complex living community.
And we're just one part of it. We're members.
Not the owners. Not the conquerors.
Precisely. And that shift from conqueror to citizen, well, that takes a huge change in how we think about responsibility, about morality even.
It's a massive ethical leap, maybe one we absolutely have to make.
Yeah. So let's talk about the man himself. Aldo Leopold, he lived from 1887 to 1948.
American forester, ecologist, writer. And what's key here, I think, is his background. It was super practical.
Very practical. Yale School of Forestry, decades with the U.S. Forest Service. This wasn't an armchair philosopher.
No, not at all. He actually basically established the whole profession of wildlife management in the U.S. A real pioneer.
And that practicality is so important because his views weren't static. They evolved. That's the fascinating part.
How so? He didn't start out with the land ethic fully formed.
Oh, not at all. He began as a pretty conventional conservationist for his time, you know, utilitarian, focused on game management.
Which often meant?
Well, it often meant getting rid of predators, seeing wolves and cougars mainly as competitors for the deer and elk that humans wanted to hunt.
Okay, so a very human-centered view initially.
Definitely. But then came this transformation. And it was personal, rooted in his field work.
You mean the famous wolf story.
Exactly. He talks about being out west, I think in Arizona or New Mexico, and shooting a mother wolf. And as he watched her die, he described seeing this fierce green fire go out in her eyes.
Wow.
And in that moment, he had this profound realization. He hadn't just killed an animal. He disrupted something essential, something valuable in itself, a piece of the whole system.
And that changed everything for him.
It seems like it cracked his old worldview wide open. He started moving away from just managing nature for human use towards understanding its intrinsic value, its own right to exist.
Which led him where?
Eventually to the University of Wisconsin, and then crucially to buying this rundown farm in central Wisconsin, the famous shack in the Sand County.
Which became his laboratory.
His living laboratory, yes. He and his family spent years doing hands-on ecological restoration there, trying to heal this worn-out piece of land. It was this incredible mix of science and deep personal care.
Trying to put his new philosophy into practice.
Exactly. Trying to heal the land he'd once, perhaps, only seen as a resource to be managed.
And that blend. The lyrical writing about nature, but also the hard-won philosophical insight. That's what makes a Sand County Almanac so powerful, right?
Totally. The structure itself is brilliant. It's like he's deliberately taking you on a journey to awaken what he calls your ecological conscience.
It's part memoir, part nature journal, part manifesto.
Yeah. And he guides you through three sort of landscapes. First, there's the really intimate journey, month by month, through the seasons at his farm, seeing it come back to life. Then he zooms out, takes you across America, drawing on all those decades of field work. A bigger spatial journey.
And finally.
Finally, the big one. The philosophical journey that leads directly to the land ethic itself.
Okay, so the core argument weaving through all of this, what is it again?
It's that the root cause of all our environmental problems is our worldview. This anthropocentric view.
Meaning human-centered.
Right. The idea that humans are separate from and superior to nature, that nature is just a big pile of resources waiting for us to use. We're the conquerors.
And Leopold says it's not just wrong ethically, it's ecologically suicidal.
Exactly. It's disastrous. So the shift we need is fundamental. We have to stop being conquerors.
And become again.
Plain members and citizens of the whole biotic community. With rights, sure, but more importantly, with responsibilities.
It's interesting who he's talking to as well. It's not just academics or politicians.
No, it feels like he's talking to everyone. Landowners, farmers, yes, but also just people who have a backyard. Anyone who interacts with the natural world, which is, well, everyone.
He's inviting us all to learn to see differently, to achieve what he calls ecological literacy.
Yeah, because the world is constantly sending us signals, telling us things, and mostly we're just not reading them.
Okay, let's dive into that first part then, the Sand County Almanac section. It's his masterclass in learning to see, right? Structured as a phenological calendar.
Mm-hmm. A month-by-month diary of what's happening on the farm.
And phenological just means tracking the timing of natural events, like when birds arrive, when plants flower.
Exactly. It forces you to pay really close attention, to notice the small changes, the connections over the course of the year.
He's teaching us to read the landscape itself. Like in that essay about February's good oak.
Oh, that's a perfect example.
It starts out sounding practical. He's cutting up an old oak, killed by lightning for firewood.
Right. But as he saws through it, he starts reading the growth rings. And suddenly, it's not just wood.
It's history.
It's a historical record. Each ring tells a story. Droughts, wet years, maybe even when settlers arrived. Decades, centuries of history embedded right there in the tree. It makes you see deep time.
That's incredible. Turning firewood into a history lesson.
And then he does something similar with the dead tree in November's A Mighty Fortress. He challenges that purely economic view again.
How so?
Well, if you only value timber, a dead standing tree looks like waste, right? Get rid of it.
Yeah, makes sense economically.
But Leopold celebrates it. He shows how this dead tree is actually a bustling hub of life. It's a home for chickadees. It's food storage for woodpeckers. It's slowly returning nutrients to the soil. It has immense value, just not, you know, market value.
So he's building the case for non-economic value step by step through observation.
Precisely. And these intimate observations from the farm then set the stage for the bigger philosophical points in the second section, sketches here and there.
Is where we get thinking like a mountain.
Yes. Which brings us back to the wolf story, really. How does that connect? He spells out the consequences of humans messing with the system. He realized, after experiences like shooting that wolf, that by removing top predators, they unleashed the deer populations.
All right. No natural check.
So the mountain itself, he means, the whole ecosystem ends up living in fear of its deer. Because too many deer strip the vegetation, they cause erosion, the whole system destabilizes.
Wow. So thinking like a mountain means thinking about the whole system, long-term stability, not just short-term human wants, like more deer to hunt.
Exactly. It requires this holistic, long-term view and a good dose of humility about our interventions.
Which connects to that other really powerful essay in this section on a monument to the passenger pigeon.
Oh, that one's chilling. He's literally standing in a monument to this bird that went from billions to zero, extinct.
And his point isn't just sadness about losing a species.
No, it's deeper. He mourns the loss of the pigeon, not just as a bird, but as a massive ecological force. They're flock-shaped forests. We didn't just lose a species. We broke a part of the ecosystem's machinery.
It forces you to think about the finality of extinction and maybe our own arrogance.
Deeply. Our hubris in destroying things we don't even understand.
So all these observations, these sketches, they build towards the final section, the upshot.
Right, where he formally lays out the land ethic. And he frames it as the next logical step in human ethical evolution.
How does he explain that?
Well, he says, look, ethics first evolved to govern how individuals treat each other. Then ethics expanded to cover how individuals relate to society.
Okay, like rules against stealing, then concepts of democracy or social responsibility.
Exactly. And Leopold says the next step, the one that's overdue, is to extend our ethics to include our relationship with the land itself, with the soil, water, plants, and animals.
So having ethical limits on how we treat nature.
Yes. And to explain why this is necessary scientifically, not just sentimentally, he introduces the biotic pyramid.
Right. The energy flow model.
Yeah. It's a way to visualize the ecosystem. Land isn't just dirt. It's a flow of energy. You've got soil at the bottom, then plants, then insects, herbivores, carnivores. Humans are up near the top.
And the point is,
point is that the whole system depends on the health and complexity of those lower layers. The energy flows upwards.
And what we tend to do is mess with the foundations.
Bingo. Industrial agriculture that depletes soil, pollution that poisons water, removing predators. We destabilize the base of the pyramid we're standing on. It disrupts the entire energy flow.
Which makes the whole structure unstable.
Catastrophically unstable, potentially. Mm-hmm. And this is why he says conservation based purely on economics is, quote, hopelessly lopsided.
Because money only values the stuff we pull off the top.
Pretty much. Timber, crops, game animals. Our economic system is mostly blind to the value of the soil microbes, the pollinators, the fungi, the predators, all those middle and bottom layers doing essential work that keeps the whole pyramid standing.
So if we only save what makes us money,
we neglect the very foundation of our own survival. It's short-sighted.
Okay, that really clarifies it. Which brings us to the absolute core message, the guiding principle. Yes, the land ethics core maxim. It's simple but profound. A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. Wow. That gives you a completely different measuring stick for your actions, doesn't it? Not just is it legal or is it profitable, but does it harm the community?
Exactly. It provides a clear, non-economic moral standard. It forces us to recognize that nature has value in itself, intrinsic value, separate from its usefulness to us. Which ties into that other huge theme, ecological conscience and humility.
Mm-hmm.
Leopold knew this wasn't just about new laws or technology, so those might help. The real change needed is deeper. It's cultural. It's internal.
You have to cultivate this ecological conscience.
Yes. Through direct experience, through paying attention, through reflection, we have to internalize this idea that we aren't the masters of the universe. We're just plain members and citizens.
That requires humility. Stepping down from that self-appointed pedestal.
A lot of humility. But it's an ethical stance grounded firmly in ecological science.
And while the philosophy is so rigorous, the way he writes, it's just beautiful, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. He had the mind of a scientist, but the soul of a poet. The book is packed with lines that just stick with you. They capture complex ideas so elegantly.
Should we share a few of those? The really standout ones?
Yep.
Definitely. Let's start with maybe the most famous one. Quote one, "We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect."
That just nails the core shift, doesn't it? From ownership to membership.
Perfectly. Ownership implies power over something. Membership implies responsibility to something. Huge difference. Okay, how about this one? Quote two, "I now suspect that just as a deer herd lives in mortal fear of its wolves, so does a mountain live in mortal fear of its deer." Thinking like a mountain distilled. It's such a brilliant flip of perspective. It makes you see the hidden consequences of imbalance, the dangers we create when we remove key parts of the system. It forces you to see the interconnectedness. Absolutely. And then there's this wonderfully pragmatic one. Quote three, "The first precept of intelligent pinkering is to save every cog and wheel." I love that. It's so simple.
It is. But it's such a powerful argument for biodiversity. We're messing around with this incredibly complex machine, the biosphere, and we barely understand how it works. So rule number one, don't throw away any of the parts.
Exactly.
Save every species, every cog and wheel, because you have no idea which ones are essential for keeping the whole thing running. It's basic caution against causing extinction.
These ideas are so compelling.
Yeah.
But how do we actually use them? Especially if, you know, you live in a city, you don't own land.
Well, Leopold actually shows us the way through his own methods. It starts with developing a sense of place.
Meeting.
Start your own phenology journal, even if it's just for the tree outside your window or the birds in the local park. Learn the names of a few local plants. Notice when the seasons really change in your specific place.
Cultivate that ecological seeing he talks about.
Mm, exactly. Find the complexity in the history, even in a small patch of ground. It connects you.
And if you do manage land, a backyard, a farm.
Then the shift is from pure exploitation to stewardship. Thinking less about maximizing just one thing, like lawn or crop yield, and more about enhancing the overall health.
Like planting native species, improving the soil.
Yes. Creating little habitats, focusing on biological health, not just output. You stop being just a user and become a caretaker.
And what about bigger scales? Policy, business. Well, the land ethic offers this radical new metric. Instead of just asking, is it profitable or does it meet minimum regulations?
Mm-hmm.
You ask Leopold's question, does this policy, this business decision, preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the ecosystem it affects? That's a much higher bar. Moving beyond just doing no harm towards actually doing good for the land.
It's a profound shift in the standard we aim for.
You know, reflecting on all this, what really hits me is Leopold's insistence that our environmental crises aren't fundamentally about technology or economics.
No, he saw them as ethical and cultural crises.
Exactly. And that means real, lasting solutions require a change in us, a change of heart, a change of mind, something that comes from, as he showed, that direct, sustained connection with nature.
Absolutely. I think the greatest gift he offers is that shift in identity. He lets us see ourselves not as masters of the earth, but as citizens. Humble, yes, but also responsible citizens of this vast, incredibly complex, beautiful community.
And his own life shows it's possible. He made that journey.
He did. From a conventional, resource-focused forester to this profound ecological philosopher, it shows that this ethical growth, this ecological education, it's available to anyone willing to put in the effort to really see the world around them.
Yeah.
It's ultimately an argument for environmentalism, rooted in love and respect.
A powerful legacy indeed. See you next time. With another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.